The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. I'd like to welcome back to the program today, Nicholas Obregon. He joins us on the phone in Los Angeles. Welcome back to the show, Nicholas.
Thank you for having me.
You've got a new novel out. It's called Unknown Mail. And we've had you on the show for two previous books in this series. And this is quite a turn again. The first book was set in Japan. The second book was set quite a bit in Southern California and in America. And then this third book, Inspector Iwata, or now Consultant Iwata, has gone back to Japan.
Mm.
You're really having fun with this, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, in the writing of it, maybe it didn't feel like much fun, but we'll go with that word.
Okay. Well, let's talk about this series, because some of our listeners aren't familiar with it. Some of them didn't hear our previous interviews. Let's start off at the beginning with the first book. Tell us about it.
So the first book is set roughly 10 years from Unknown Mail, roughly 2011. And it is about a Japanese detective who is very lonely. And he's Japanese, but he's grown up in California, so he has this biculturality. And he's tasked with solving the murder of a family in Tokyo. And then, you know, complications ensue.
Mm-hmm. They sure do. And that story, you don't have to read these books in order, but if you did read that first book, it would help you understand some of the things that are talked about in this new book, Unknown Mail.
Yeah, I mean, it's the character arc across the three novels follows him pretty much every 5 years, and so he's obviously changed a great deal from the first story right up to Unknown Mail, which takes place more or less in the present. And so it's not a must; everything would make sense, and you would be able to fill in blanks without having read the previous two. But certainly I know from readers that they've enjoyed following that arc and seeing him change and grow.
Especially getting to meet Shindo in the first book and seeing what remains of him in the third book. Okay, let's talk about the second book, which is really different.
Yeah. So the second book is after the events of Blue Light Yokohama, which is the first novel. Iwata is done with the Tokyo Metropolitan Police, and he moves back to California to begin his own private investigations agency. And he is given the case of a series of transgender women who are found dead in throughout Los Angeles. So he basically is living, you know, thousands of miles away, starting up this new life, but by investigating these murders, it starts to prick and poke at his old wounds, and eventually his investigation takes him into the borderlands between northern Mexico and the U.S.
And he's kind of an exile in that book, and in this third book, he's called back to Japan, and this is very odd because most of the police, his former colleagues, they don't want anything to do with him. And you did set this, as you say, in the present. This really is in the present because you've got the Olympics in Japan just getting ready to begin.
Yeah, which, you know, in the book, it suggests it's the 2020 Olympics, which obviously this is written before COVID. So there's a slight kind of timeline continuity error there. But yeah, and so he's still in Los Angeles at the very beginning of the story. He's done with Japan. For him, Japan only holds painful memories and ghosts. But at the same time, he's suffering with this PTSD. So after 10 years away, when Shindo, his old boss, calls him up with one last job, Iwata decides that maybe it is time to confront those nightmares once and for all. So he takes the case of a murdered exchange student who's found dead in a love hotel with only a dead spider for company. But he takes the case on his own terms and with ulterior motives to kind of put those nightmares to bed once and for all.
Can we talk about his ulterior motives at all, what he really wants to accomplish at all?
Yeah, so the in the first two novels, we explore the root of his trauma, why he is the way he is. And throughout the first two novels, we start to see his past. So he grows up partly in an orphanage. Now his mother is alive, but he's left in this orphanage because he's abandoned in a bus stop in the mountains. So he grows up in this orphanage pretty much alone. And then at the age of 16, she comes back for him with an American father and says, right, we're going to go to California to have this new life. And so then throughout that first novel and the second novel, we see his past, we see the background in which he's grown up in. And in this third novel, we understand that the kind of architect of all of his pain and trauma has been his father. And so he begins the novel by accepting the case and going back to Japan. But we see very early on that he's doing this because he wants to confront his father and make things right.
Mm. Well, if I had to come up with a theme for Unknown Male, it would be evil fathers.
Yes, exactly this.
Because, man, you've got some very evil people in here. And these two fathers I'm referring to, they're barely in the story, but their presence is so looming throughout the story. And you've got these people working in the police department, and our inspector Iwata shows up, but he's no longer an inspector. They're calling him consultant, and he's not getting respected. And then they bring in this woman from England who's a constable, Constable Lynch, and she's kind of an exile too. And I really liked the pairing that you came up with here. I think these two really work well together.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, the kind of primary inspiration behind the story, at least from the outside, was the disappearance of a young English woman, Lucy Blackman, 20 years ago. She disappeared in the summer of 2000 in Japan, and her parents obviously went out to try and find her, and they were promptly sucked into this kind of odyssey of false leads and the kind of shadowy sex industry in Japan and the disparities between the legal system there and what they were used to. So Iwata is investigating a similar case, but as you rightly say, that the heart of this book is evil, both externally and internally, the kind of inherited evil. So as you rightly say, I wanted both Iwata and Lynch to have their own kind of darkness and for them to be battling darkness externally in terms of the case and murders and so on, but also to be fighting their own demons on the inside. So it was a lot of, it gave me a great deal of pleasure to have them kind of play off each other and not trust each other necessarily to begin with, but slowly as the story progresses for them to recognize that they both have these kind of shared traumas.
In case you're just tuning in, you're listening to 91.3 WYSO, Making Radio with the Community and for the Community, and Making Radio today with Nicolas Obregon, who joins us on the telephone in Los Angeles. We're talking about his Unknown Male. It's a new thriller, and I read a lot in this genre, and I try to avoid certain writers who write such scary stuff that I almost cannot bear to turn the pages. And I see one of these writers that I actually try to avoid really likes you. He called you a masterpiece or one of your books, Jeffrey Deaver. Jeffrey Deaver is like so far over the edge. I can't read him because his stuff is just too dark for me. And you had me right on the edge with the dark because your guy, Mr. Sato, I'm telling you, I was having a really hard time with him. I mean, I made it through, but man, he is just like the creepiest, scariest character I think I've ever encountered in a novel.
Well, I mean, that, you know, maybe that's a testament to me being messed up, but to me, that's a great compliment. So Mr. Sato, which is, Sato is kind of like the Japanese equivalent to Smith or Jones. It's kind of a very common surname. You know, as we said, the heart of this story is evil. And I have done, like many crime authors, a lot of reading about serial killers and what makes them tick and so on. I spoke to lots of criminal profilers, and there seems to be a disconnect to me in the genre where there's this kind of comic book way in which killers are often presented. Some lurid calling card, or they kill their victims in some fantastical or highly specific way. But the profilers I spoke to pretty much all said the same thing, which is that these men are almost always unremarkable. They are narcissistic, and they will use other people and their lives for their own gratification. But the idea of a killer, you know, taunting the police or talking to them, this hardly ever happens. You know, these men are preoccupied only with themselves. So in my book, Mr. Sato, he embodies that idea of the banality of evil. I mean, he's a good father, he's a good employee, he gets the same train to work every day, and he never, ever stands out. And I think it's because of his plainness, because he is unremarkable, because he is a good father, and he helps his kid do his homework and so on. I think that's part of the reason why he's so discomforting to read. I think that that's part of his... you know, why he is evil is because he's not all evil. Somehow that's kind of more terrifying than some, you know, comic book evil where just everything they do is bad and they exist only to hurt people. So I'm pleased you had that reaction, Dick.
Well, it's true on the surface that Sato is a good father, but at one point in the story, he's talking to his son. He's kind of given his son the skinny on what life's all about and what he should think and believe. And his wife overhears the conversation. And I think it's kind of hard to say he was being a good father when he was having this conversation. The poor kid. Oh, man. The kid really isn't in it that much. I mean, he's just sort of a pawn. But when you get to the end of that particular sequence of events with Sato and the culmination of his madness, that is just like so wild. What an amazing thing. And what you have here is you have two threads, and you wonder if they're going to converge. You have the attempt to solve the murder of this exchange student, and then you have these missing women in this area where there's a lot of, would you say, prostitution? And so... They don't know if there's a linkage between these two. And I read a lot, like I say, in this genre. And so I'm always trying to guess who did it. And I got to admit, the exchange student, I knew who did it when you introduced that character. I said, this person, this person did it. Now I don't think a lot of people were going to get that. But frankly, I said, this guy's too weird.
Well, yeah, I guess I'm hoping there that, you know, most people who read the book aren't coming at it with that kind of black belt knowledge that you have there, Vic.
No, that's the fun of it. I'm sure a lot of people who read these kinds of books go, oh, man, I guessed it, or I didn't, or they totally threw me. Mm-hmm. And occasionally I'll get lucky. It's like throwing a dart at a dartboard. You occasionally get lucky and you guess, okay, I picked this one.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, without giving anything away, yeah, there was that. It was a lot of fun for me, kind of presenting from the beginning that there is Mr. Sato in this world. He is there. He does do these things, and then playing with the reader's expectation of, well, I mean, that would make sense, but surely it can't be him. You know, that's a lot of fun with me. You know, subverting and playing with and kind of flirting with the reader. That's one of the pleasures.
Let's talk about Shindo a little bit, because he's an amazing character, and in this one, he's a wisp of himself. He's just barely there, but he's the one who brought Iwata back to Japan. He still has power, and he still cares about solving crimes, but he's fading into the twilight.
Yeah. And I mean, for me, it's something that I... often struggle with, let's say, killing off a character, especially one that you feel an affinity with. But not that that's a spoiler, but I think that, you know, like life, losing people you care about has to be part of fiction. And so when we see him at the beginning of the third story, Whereas in the first book, he's, you know, one of the main characters. He's the one who brings Iwata into the Metropolitan Police Department to begin with. Obviously, in this third story, he's very sick and he knows he's facing the end. And so he's concerned with his legacy. He's concerned with how he will be remembered. And so when the world's kind of eye is on Tokyo because the Olympics are coming, he knows that this foreign girl being killed in a love hotel is going to kind of stain his legacy. So he reaches out for Iwata. And so there was that element of making him a wisp of himself and paring back from the kind of Shindo that I was writing by reflex, you know, kind of telling myself that, no, he's very sick. He doesn't, that's not how he is anymore. And seeing that impact in Iwata's eyes, you know, seeing Iwata after 10 years realizing this man is dying. He's an old man now.
I have never been to Japan, and your image of Tokyo is very much a character in this story. We travel to all these different neighborhoods and we see all these different things, and you have this community of homeless people, and they're very much part of the story. Let's talk a little bit about the underside of Tokyo, and you apparently have extensive knowledge of it. How do you know so much about this metropolis?
First and foremost is the magic of books. Doing a lot of reading will always give you the appearance of knowing stuff. It was going there on research trips and spending time in those streets and trying to talk with people. And I think for me, there is this, there is a pleasure in subverting stereotypes, because when you hear the word Japan, it often conjures these images of skyscrapers and modernity and so on. And of course, that is there. But I think there is also this idea that it is somehow a utopia and that everything works and everything is on time. And of course, comparisons are useless in many ways. But, you know, there is homelessness and there are problems. And so I wanted to look at that in order to kind of show the reader, or in order to speak to the reader and say, look, you know, this idea you have of the place, there's a grain of truth to it, but also it is wrong. And also there are human beings who live under bridges and so on, like anywhere.
Mm-hmm. You have this one character, he's a homeless guy, and he's the one who witnesses a key evidentiary proceeding. He sees a guy who he says looks like George Harrison disposing of something. I love this character. He obviously just makes little cameo appearances, but he's just a wonderful little character.
Mm. Well, so that character, so he's a homeless man who lives under this particular flyover, this kind of freeway in Sanya, which is this area of Tokyo, which Sanya officially no longer exists, but people still call it that because that's what the area was. But the government changed the name of it to try and wash its hands. Mm. And so this man, he's based on a real guy who was there in real life, who lived in a box under the bridge, but was wearing this kind of tatty pinstripe suit and had a mobile phone from, you know, let's say 20 years ago or wherever it was, who clearly had not accepted that his circumstances had changed. And so from the little I could make out, other people were kind of having fun at his expense, but he either seemed to be oblivious or to not care. And so he, you know, when you see someone like that as a writer, that's one of those kind of rubies in the dust where you think, okay, that guy's going straight into the story by hook or by crook.
Mm-hmm. The book is Unknown Mail. I've been joined by the author Nicolas Obregón on the telephone in Los Angeles in one of those skyscrapers, our version of an L.A. skyscraper as opposed to a Tokyo skyscraper. So how'd you become so fascinated with Japan? You're clearly someone who's a citizen of the world. You've been all over. What is it about Tokyo and Japan that you find so intriguing?
I mean, the thing that I find most intriguing about Japan is that as someone who's been fortunate to travel a great deal, wherever I go, I tend to get these echoes. So, you know, as someone who grew up between London in the UK and Madrid in Spain, I speak the two, you know, two of the most common languages in the world. And so when I would go to Argentina for the first time, let's say many years ago, of course, it's a new country and I'm learning new things and having new experiences, but there are these echoes of familiarity of these kind of shared cultures. And I think for the first time when I went to Japan, it was the first time in my life where I'd been somewhere where I thought, there is nowhere like this place. It stands alone. It is that physical island, but also kind of this kind of spiritual, cultural island as well. And so as a child, growing up in Madrid, there was this TV show, and it was called Oliver and Benji. It was about the two kids who played football in Japan. And it was dubbed into Spanish, but of course, I knew as a kid that this wasn't Spain because of the haircuts people had, because of the trains they were getting on, because of the food they were eating. I knew there was this place that existed beyond Spain. And so I think my early experiences of story were really shaped by this TV show, video games, even anime movies. And so for me as a kid, I was always aware that there was this place that was different. And they had these stories which really moved me. So I think that's kind of baked into the cake very early on.
Okay. Now tell us about the publishing situation on this, because the first two interviews we did books that were published by Minotaur, and then this third book you published by a very prestigious imprint out of the UK, Penguin. What's the story with the publishing here? Was this book ever released in the U.S., or is it going to be? What's the setup on this?
So essentially the deal is that I was given a two-book deal with Minotaur here in the U.S. Uh-huh. and a four-book deal with Penguin back in the U.K. So all of the Iwata novels are published with Penguin in the U.K., but essentially for U.S. readers to access Unknown Mail, it's just a case of going online and ordering the U.K. version. So the only difference is that, I don't know, the letter neighbor will have an extra U in it and so on and so forth, but it should still be legible to the Americans.
Well, that clarifies it. So you're saying there's a fourth book?
There is a fourth book. It will. It's a standalone novel, though, so it's not going to be an Inspector Iwata novel. In very brief terms, it is concerned with a murder that occurs in an Amish community in unnamed rural America, and a detective has to come and cross into and out of both worlds to solve it. That should be out sometime late next year.
An Amish community? You are really going somewhere different here. How'd you get that idea?
Well, I went to Pennsylvania, and I went to a tourist attraction, and I was standing on this bridge, and a group of Amish people were having a day out, and I was listening to the language that they spoke. Uh-huh. I recognized some words in German, but I didn't yet know that they weren't actually speaking German. They were speaking a kind of 300-400-year-old dialect of German that only they speak in the world. And it snowballed from there. I thought, you know, what a fascinating thing to live in America, but essentially to live in your own tiny little country where it's a closed society and you have your own rules, and either you are inside or you are outside, and it's like night and day, it's that clear. And so I thought, well, what if a murder happened and the outside had to come in? And it kind of went from there. Not many people know of this, and I think it's a surprise to them to realize that, you know, there are people born in America right now who won't learn English as their first language in these communities.
Well, I'm really curious about that. And is that in progress? You're writing it right now?
I am about three chapters out from finishing, so I'm kind of losing my sanity somewhat. But yes, it should be sent off to my publisher very shortly. And then I have a series of nebulous writing projects, which are plates spinning in my mind that aren't far out from being finished either.
Well, don't you do some travel writing?
I used to be a travel writer for a travel magazine, uh-huh. and they were the ones who actually sent me to Japan to begin with. But then that magazine folded whilst I was out there.
Oh.
So I thought, well, at least I got to go. So, yeah, they were the ones who bankrolled that first experience. So thank you to Witch Magazine.
Okay. My guest is Nicolas Obregón, and we're talking about his new novel, Unknown Mail. And I was really impressed by this novel. And so this is the end of Iwata.
For now, yeah. I mean, never say never, but he's earned a vacation, I think.
Okay. And you apparently earned a vacation as well, because we've been communicating through messages, and I understand you just got back from, was it the Basque country in Spain?
I was in the Basque country in Spain, yeah. It was mainly Madrid, where my family is from. One of my closest cousins got married, so I was out there for a month.
So you got a little break from your Amish novel.
Yes, I did. I mean, I was still working on it whilst I was out there.
Okay.
But, you know, whilst I was having a few tapas.
Now, when you were doing your research, did you actually go to Pennsylvania? Are you just finding this stuff online? What kind of stuff are you researching as far as the language and the culture of the Amish?
Yeah, so I went to Pennsylvania. I spent time driving around there. I mean, it's not a very forthcoming culture in that, you know, you can't just turn up and knock on the door and say, hey, would you like to talk about this? Lots of reading, research trips. And then, you know, in terms of the language, we're kind of understanding the kind of the before and after in Amish history and how it branches off in its own directions. The history of Pennsylvania itself, why it's called what it's called, how it kind of begins, all of that feeds in. And so then quite early on, I realized that what I was going to do is to make my own kind of quasi-Amish sect, so that they were going to be not technically Amish, that they would be kind of distant cousins, but it would allow me to go off in different directions and kind of give them slightly different beliefs and different customs, literally just for the ease of, you know, authorship, really. It is a tremendously fascinating, subject.
I like that. There are, really are different sects within the Amish, and there are different belief systems. Different. You've got your Mennonites. You've got your Amish. Do your Amish still celebrate what they call Rumspringa?
Yes, so in my particular segment, in my particular sect, they don't celebrate that, but they do have what is referred to as tendering. And in this tendering process, young women of a certain age go to the outside, typically to a farm, to do some kind of work experience, as it were, to make a bit of money in order to kind of put this money towards the upkeep of their village. So their village is called the Samlung, and the Samlung is Old German for assembly. And their kind of origin story is that their founder in this, you know, kind of horrible winter was leading them into the cold and they had nowhere to go. And he finds this dead poplar tree. And inside this tree, there is this miraculous unseasonal beehive. And so he takes the honey out and feeds his people with this honey, and it becomes sacred to them. So the tasting of the honey is one of their sacraments, and it kind of feeds into the novel and clues later on in the mystery.
Ooh, that's very biblical stuff there.
Indeed.
I like it. I'll look forward to that. I hope we can do another interview when that book is out.
It would be a pleasure.
That'd be great. My guest has been Nicolas Obregón. We've been talking about his book, Unknown Male, and it's the third book in a series which features Inspector Iwata. The first book is Blue Light Yokohama, which was inspired by a very haunting piece of music, and every time I hear that song, I think about your books.
It's so funny how something as simple as hearing a song in the background can not only inspire a story but go on to change your entire life.
The second book is called Sins as Scarlet, and the third one, Unknown Male, just out. And you heard about it on the Book Nook. Thank you so much, Nicolas. Really appreciate it.
Thank you to you, Vic. Lovely to be here. Thank you.
For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.